I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today it's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning.
Good morning.
And of course, we would love to hear from you this morning with your bird stories, comments, or questions. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. It's been a little bit mild. And it's been quite a weird winter this has been.
It's been a really weird winter. And you know, you get that those polar vortices, dreaded polar vortex. And we remember those crazy deep freezes we had that were so abnormal.
And then one day, it's like spring.
Right. And so they were sort of the exception that proved the rule. Like, geez, this doesn't happen anymore. The harbors don't freeze very often anymore. And they don't. But they froze during that period. But now we're back to kind of milder than average weather. And I looked at the future forecast, you know, the projections for the next few weeks. Always dangerous, you know, don't pin your hopes. But all of the temperatures predicted were above normal. I mean, today's cold, but everything else was predicted to be more like March averages. And that's sort of been the trend. The way climate change has registered in these parts is warmer winter temperatures on average. You know, higher low temperatures, that kind of thing. Not as many lows in the 20s, you know, more lows above freezing. And so that's been the trend for many years, and that's why, you know, the harbors don't freeze as often anymore. But, of course, you know, you have to look at those things over the long term. You're going to get cold snaps, and people are like, oh, how about that global warming now? You know, the dopes. You know, to some extent, the cold snaps are predicted by climate change and some of the because most of the warming is in the Arctic or more of the warming is at the poles, that sort of destabilizes things up there. And you get these weird conditions where it's colder here than in Fairbanks.
Yeah.
And that's been happening more lately. But it's all part of it. But you know, it's definitely been milder on average, and it looks like February will be milder than average.
Yeah. So we haven't had any wild winds or weather really. We had some rain, but not a lot of unusual visitors in the last couple of weeks. Have we seen anything?
Not too many. But before we get to put a pin in that.
Okay, pin in that.
Because there was a study I wanted to talk about while we were just talking about kind of, you know, milder than average winters and how that's been the trend. This was one of those things, I'm not going to remember the researchers or even the university. It was one of those things I was reading on my phone as I was falling asleep. But a really cool long-term study in Algonquin Park, the provincial park up there in Canada, which is a great place for boreal forest animals and birds. You know, lots of spruce bogs and kind of classic, you know, cold northern boreal forests. And people have been studying gray jays there for 30 years.
Oh.
Gray jay is probably not familiar to a lot of people around here unless you go camping up north, like, you know, way north, you know, northern Maine. They're in the White Mountains and, you know, occasionally in certain places where you can get them, but mainly Canadian boreal forest, northern tier of states kind of bird. Really, really cool birds. They call them camp robbers because they're really drawn to people, and they'll come in and they'll be very friendly and they'll land on your picnic table and then they'll take your food, fly
and
away.
Run. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're well known to, you know, in logging camps and things like that up in the north. But some researchers, ornithologists have been studying up there for 30 plus years, and they've been declining. I think they've declined by like 50%.
Wow.
In Algonquin Provincial Park. And they're pretty sure they figured out why, and it's one of the only kind of direct links to climate change that you can find for a species decline. You know, a lot of it is sort of presumed and theoretical, but gray jays cache food, so they're really weird. I mean, they survive really, you know, well below zero temperatures, and they'll be breeding. They're about the size of a blue jay, maybe a little bigger, fluffier, but they cache food during the summer, meaning they'll take, you know, insects and nuts and things and just stash them in like flakes of bark on the black spruces and things. And that's what gets them through the winter, and that's what they'll feed their young. And so they'll be breeding like now up there, you know, where
cold,
you can imagine
yeah.
what the temperatures are up there. But what the researchers found is that their food was going bad because of warmer average winter
wow.
temperatures. So it's like, you know, when you lose power, and your food goes bad in the fridge, that's sort of what's been happening to them. And there was some experimental evidence for that when they, you know, they would cache their own, the researchers would cache some food and they would look at its condition at the end of the winter, you know, under different temperatures, you know, different years. And it seems like their food is just going bad. And so they found that their reproduction was terrible after warmer than average winters.
That's interesting.
And so it was a really interesting direct link to, you know, an effect of climate, a direct effect of climate change on the breeding success of a bird. It's not easy to find that, you know.
So would they move their territory a little north? Or, well, I guess it's warming there too, right? So
yeah. And so another thing they did is they looked at a site further north where the temperatures are more like what they used to be in Algonquin Park, and they found that they had better breeding success and the food wasn't going bad, you know, so they still had kind of normal cold Canadian winters still up there. Mm. So it's just a really interesting study.
Yeah.
Okay,
all
now
right.
We can get on to your next question.
Which was, what, have we seen anything interesting?
Yeah.
I'm just not going to kid you. It's been chickadees and
it's been slow. In terms of, you know, interesting bird, there's always good stuff around, but it's been pretty slow. In terms of rarities and things like that, somebody had a rose-breasted grosbeak. There's been a couple of rose-breasted grosbeaks, which is very strange, very unusual for winter. It's just not one of those birds that, you know, that most of them migrate to the tropics and you get a few that stay here. Well, not normally. Mm-hmm. None stay here in a typical year. And there was one in Woods Hole for a while somewhere around here, I think into January. And then there was this one that just turned up in Truro. And it's just very strange. Mm. So it obviously survived those deep cold snaps somehow.
Huh?
But, you know, there aren't a ton of fancy, you know, rarities at people's feeders,
you know,
or anything
what, though,
right now.
It may not be a rarity anymore, but we've been seeing some bald eagles, which is pretty exciting. And I know I have an email from, let's see, who is this from? This is from Rebecca on the Vineyard. She says, I saw a bald eagle at Edgartown Great Pond in Martha's Vineyard on January 22nd. What a neat experience. So there's that one. Then a friend of mine told me she saw a bald eagle walking her dog in Katamit. And
How did the eagle hold the leash?
Right. She was walking the dog.
Okay, yeah. Thank God.
So she looks up and she says, what the heck is that big bird up there? And then she saw the white head and she was very excited. And she went back the next day and it was there the next day too. But you have an even more exciting story. Like seven of them somewhere?
Well, somebody reported, I think it was on the Cape Cod Birders Facebook group. You know, it's all about social media these days. And somebody reported, and I think they had some photos. There were six one day at, I think it's called Jenkins Pond. It's a pond I've never been to that's not that far from here in Falmouth. And then they went back the next day and they saw two adults where they'd only seen one adult the previous. So there were seven bald eagles at this kind of modest size, good size pond, but, you know, not huge, over 24 hours. So that's the kind of winter it's been. I mean, that's unusual, but at some of the typical spots like Mashpee Wakeby and Long Pond and Harwich, you know, you can see two or three, maybe four. And then there was five, I think, at Nye Pond and Sandwich. Mm-hmm. I think I talked about that last time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what happened is the deep freeze that we had one in December and then another one end of December, early January. And I think that froze things up further north and pushed a lot of eagles our way. Mm. And a lot of them stuck around. Now we're getting into the time where, some of these winter visitor eagles are still around. But it's getting to be time where if there are local breeders, they'll be getting down to breeding. Somebody called me from Wareham and said they saw a pair of adult bald eagles hanging around an osprey nest. And that's happened a few different times. It doesn't mean they're definitely going to nest there, the eagles, and if they do, not successfully. But it's just indicative that eagles are thinking about nesting here. They're trying to on occasion. And I've talked about this numerous times on this show. You know, they may very well be nesting somewhere in around Mashpee Wakeby Pond or, you know, somewhere in the Punghorn and Brewster, that big forest, or, you know, where there's a bunch of ponds there, Long Pond and Harwich. Somewhere around there, they may actually be breeding now under the radar.
Yeah.
And you would think, how do they hide?
Because they're gigantic birds.
Their nests weigh thousands of pounds. How are we not finding them? But they're pretty
good. They're up
in
the trees.
They'll hide them in like a white pine.
Mm-hmm.
surprisingly well.
Yeah.
And so it's harder than you think.
Yeah, but go back to that osprey nest for a second. I would think that would not be ideal for them because they usually do have all that kind of cover with the trees around
right.
it. So why would they even be thinking about the osprey nest?
Right. They may be, you know, inexperienced birds, first-time nesters. They'd be about 5 years old at that point. By the time an eagle gets that classic, iconic adult plumage, white head, white tail that everyone recognizes, it's 5 years old. So they have a long kind of immature period mm-hmm. of multiple years where they're mostly brown with kind of splotchy white, confuses people sometimes. But yeah, so it's five-year-old birds, but they may have never nested before.
So like, hey, this looks like a good spot. Let's check it out.
The same thing happens with ospreys. You get these first-time breeders that come back from wherever, Venezuela, wherever they spent their first 2 years, and then they come back in their first breeding season and usually are not successful. They'll have what we call a play nest where, you know, two young birds will get together and, like, play house, and it's adorable. but they, you know, they move sticks around and make a little nest somewhere. But they don't generally have eggs or successfully raise any young. That would be, you know, the next year if they're lucky, if they can get a decent territory. So, you know, with raptors, it often takes a few years. The bigger the raptors, the longer it takes for them to become breeding age and, you know, figure out the whole nesting thing. So my guess is with these eagles, it's happened a couple times. It happened in Brewster. it's happened around the big Lakeville ponds where there are nesting bald. There have been nesting bald eagles in Lakeville for years around the Assawamset Ponds complex. And Tom French from Mass Wildlife has told me that it's happened there where, or somebody from Mass Wildlife told me that, where a bald eagle has tried to nest in an osprey nest. And then amazingly, the ospreys come back and kick butt. You
Which
know, they're
is
like,
so
get out
funny.
Of here.
Yeah,
yes.
My house, beat it.
Right. Because they're smaller. And
you wouldn't think they'd be able to kick out an eagle, would
right.
you?
Right. Eagles are clearly dominant in squabbles over food. But something about, like, you know, you're not going to take over my nest. No. And the ospreys just come back and are ferocious, and they've managed to kick out the eagles a couple different times.
Yeah, that's funny. You know, you're making me think of I've also seen some chatter about ravens. And, you know, that's another species that we haven't really seen breeding on the Cape, right? I think somewhere maybe by one of the bridges or something near the canal. Is that like where we've had some breeding ravens?
On the power plant, yeah, the canal and
there
sandwich.
It is, the power plant.
Yeah, on a
but
catwalk.
Do we think we may see some ravens moving onto the Cape? I mean, have you heard anything about that? I've heard
yeah,
people saying
I mean,
they're spotting them, but I don't know
yeah.
about breeding.
So they've gone from a wow, ravens on the Cape, you know, to yeah, you see them more often, you know. They're pretty common to see now and again in Provincetown and Truro. I don't know if they're breeding out there.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll see two or three. So we don't have a definite nest anywhere but the power plant at the canal
it
yet.
Could be coming.
But yeah, they're coming. I mean, they have clearly changed their nesting habits in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. So when I was a kid, that was a bird of the wilderness,
yeah.
right? You go up to the mountains, you know, northern New England, the call of the raven, symbol of wildness. Now they're nesting on, you know, fire escapes at Wellesley College, Verizon Towers in Brockton. You know, I grew up in Brockton. Not a lot of wilderness in Brockton, at least not the nature kind.
Yeah.
And so they've just adopted suburbia and even urban places, quarries, you know, around Boston. So they've basically made their peace with us, and I think they'll just be going up and up from here.
Yeah. Molly has sent us an email. She says, hi, should I change out my suet frequently, even when there is still a lot left over? My husband says that it goes bad, which does not make sense.
I wouldn't worry too much about the suet. I guess, but right, if there's a real warming period and then you see the birds not using it, yeah, get rid of it. Throw it away. And don't chuck it in the woods. You know, I can't do that anymore because my dog will get it.
Mm.
And you shouldn't do it anyway. Just, you know, throw it in the trash if you do want to switch it out and get some new stuff. But yeah, you know, take your cues from the birds. If they're not visiting it anymore and it's been kind of warm, then change it out. Same goes for your seed. You know, we've had a lot of wet weather recently.
Get moldy. Yeah,
yeah, you got to clean. I had to clean out one of my feeders and you'd be surprised how gross it gets, and that's not good. You know, mold's not good for anybody, and so Take it apart, clean it out, use a little bit of bleach, put it back up, change out your suet if you feel like it's been getting too warm and it's not getting used. But
I don't think I've ever had, well, maybe a little teeny bit of suet I've had to throw out when I do. But I mean, the birds go crazy, especially this time of year.
Yeah, I've not had to throw out suet. Yeah, they love it.
Yeah, as long as the birds are there, they're happy. 866-999-4626 is our telephone number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk about birds in love after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Our phone number for your bird comments, questions, or thoughts, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Valentine's Day tomorrow. So
yep.
There are birds who mate for life, right? Others who do not.
And this is the question everybody has when it comes to bird mating. Everybody wants to think about, they like the idea of things mating for life, right?
Mm-hmm.
We just feel better about our choices. and I don't know how many birds mate for life, but the majority of birds are at least what they call in the business socially monogamous.
Mm-hmm.
That means within any one breeding season, the average songbird, the average bird, really, like 92% of bird species, will mate with one other individual, go through the nesting season, and then they'll go their separate ways. And then the next season, they start over and may or may not nest with the same pair or the same mate. But when you start really looking at the details, things kind of fall apart, and you realize they're not all that different from people, right? So yeah, they're socially monogamous, but when they've looked at the genetics, something like it's 10 to 25% of chicks were fathered by a bird other than the mate. And so so something that they call euphemistically extra pair copulations. I think we have that in human mating systems, too. There was a show called Cheaters that was based on extra pair copulations, I think. So, you know, these are the kind of terms that scientists use. And so that's a thing that happens, you know. And the animal behaviorists who study bird mating systems, they actually use the term divorce. I think there's no better term. They usually put it in quotes, you know, like...
it's not a legal proceeding.
Right. Yeah, right. I don't think the female gets half, or you know, there's like, no
my nest,
custody issues, but they'll call it divorce, and everything is about resources. So it's usually like you know, another male will have a better provision territory, and so she'll divorce her current male and you know move into another territory. So that will happen, and so these are exceptions within that socially monogamous framework that a lot of birds have. So,
But are there birds that will stay together for their, like, you hear that about ducks and bald eagles. We were talking about bald eagles.
I don't
even
know if we can talk about ducks. They're the dirtiest birds of all. Good Lord.
All right. So they're not so much, huh?
We'll get letters, but I do want to talk about ducks a little bit. But
yeah.
It's pretty salacious. But yeah, there are birds that mate for life. So until death do they part,
right?
So ospreys mate for life.
Mm-hmm.
So they live a long time. So they could be together for 20 years, a pair. Right? And so people like that. It makes us feel better. But the reality is if one member of the pair dies, you know, they don't mourn. They really move on. And if there's another male around, you know, they'll have another mate within half an hour sometimes. What about mute swans?
They supposedly mate for life.
I'm
right?
sure they do. They're not super mobile. It's very hard for them to get up, and they're one of the heaviest flying birds in the world. I'm sure they do. A male gets a good a good pond with a lot of nice aquatic vegetation to eat, and so the female would be it behooves her to stay there and for them to stay together year after year.
And where did this name mute swan come from? Because they're not mute. People think they don't make any noise, but they
do. Because in a lot of cases, idiots named birds. There's many, many examples of it. I don't know who these people were, if they were just, you know, being sarcastic or something, like, oh, let's call it a mute swan.
I haven't noticed it making any noise.
Yeah.
But
it never talks to me.
We actually have, I think, some noise of a mute swan.
Oh, yeah, they make noise.
Here we go.
Yep. Beautiful.
Yeah, there
I think
we
that's
go.
Why they're mute. People are always telling them to shut up.
Be quiet, yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird sound. And
you
hear it more than you'd expect for a bird called the mute swan, but mm-hmm. they're not generally very vocal.
Yeah. All right, I took you away from your
that's fine.
Birds that mate for
always happy to talk about stupid bird names. There are lots of them.
So what else do we want to know about birds mating? Anything?
Oh, well, there's all kinds of other systems. So, you know, we talked about the social monogamy, and there's all kinds of different things that can happen within that basic framework. So, you know, take a closer look at your neighborhood cardinals or whatever, and keep an eye on that female.
See what she's
doing.
Yeah,
is she hanging out with another male? But there are, the other systems are where things get interesting, so the exceptions to that. So another common one is called polygyny, not polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like polygyny, like mm-hmm. many females,
mm-hmm.
right? And while this did not describe my high school experience, this does describe the mating system of red-winged blackbirds.
Oh, my.
And so a successful red-winged blackbird male is a stud with essentially a harem, right? So he'll... and so there are a lot of things that happen. This determines a lot of the natural history of red-winged blackbirds, including how far they go for the winter, you know, males versus females, that kind of thing. And so because there's so much competition among males, they're loud. They have those red epaulets, mm-hmm. that we know so well, and they flash those, and they're singing constantly. They're constantly trying to secure and defend the best quality territory they can, because that will determine how many females they get to mate with in their harem. And they're not helping with the nests. In these systems, the males don't help with the nests. They just secure a good territory and then mate with as many females as they can. And so the males like to winter further north so they can quickly scoot back. There's already male redwing.
Yeah.
They're already back, some. And that's because, there we go. Very nice.
I'm here.
Oh, it's such a hopeful sound this time of year, isn't it?
I know, yeah.
We know we have a lot of crappy weather left to go, but at least the red-winged blackbirds are coming back.
Exactly.
And there's some other spring stuff we'll talk about later. And so, you know, lots of females is the key. And so they're aggressive, they're loud, they're bright, they're flashing those epaulets, and they'll winter in colder places just so they can quickly scooch back in the spring and get to a territory before the other males. The females will winter further south because, you know, they don't have that same pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of an interesting system. And there are a lot of, for some reason, it's common among marsh birds and grassland birds, birds of open kind of herbaceous habitats without a lot of trees. So whatever it is about those environments, and I'm sure there's some theories about this, because this is all about, you know, resources.
Right.
Monogamy tends to be more common in, I guess, worse habitats where food is a little bit more scarce. And when food is less scarce, you get more kind of promiscuous type mating systems. And there are birds with just totally promiscuous mating systems where anything goes, you know, they're not monogamous for 10 minutes, never mind a whole season or mating for life.
Are these the ducks?
It's like Woodstock, you know, everybody's mating with everybody else. And there are examples of that. It's not common. It's some like 4% of birds or something
so
like that.
So it's a small percentage. All right.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Steve, who's giving us a call from Provincetown. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good.
I'm afraid I have some bad news about the rose-breasted grosbeak.
Oh,
no.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he showed up at our feeder on January 31st. We sent him into eBird, and Jeremiah was sort of doubtful at first.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And Jeremiah said, great bird, great bird. He continued to come to our feeder every day, several times a day. He would sort of set himself up on the feeder and keep away all of the other cardinals, but he had let the smaller birds join him. But we also happen to have a Cooper's hawk that comes by three or four times a day.
Oh, no.
So,
I see where this is going.
Yeah, so on Saturday, my partner Frank was taking pictures of him as usual, and all of a sudden, whack, and he was gone. And we watched the Cooper's Hawk sort of devour him down at the bottom of the hill behind our house.
So, oh, no. Oh, Steve and Frank, I didn't realize it was you guys.
Yeah. So, it's us.
So would this be because they're so... You don't usually see them, so it's this poor little grosbeak stood out, right?
Well, I guess. It wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, it wasn't an adult male. It was like a young male, sort of muted.
He was browner. He wasn't really dark.
Right.
He was brown, and he was just hanging around. If he let the other cardinals come in and sit with him, the hawk might have gotten one of them.
But yeah. Oh, that's so sad. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Sad. My poor partner Frank was just shocked. He had the camera on it and everything.
Oh my goodness!
He couldn't speak for hours.
Oh jeez. Wow. Yeah, people don't always like the Cooper's Hawks. I always have to remind people that hawks need to eat
too. They have to eat too. Yeah.
People don't want to see what happens. Yeah. You know, it's like seeing the sausage being made. You don't want to see. You don't want to see the hawks eating the birds. Yeah. You know they do it. Oh, very good.
Right.
Oh, Brian's on it.
That's a Cooper's Hawk.
All right,
thank you.
I wasn't going to give you my name because I was afraid people would hate me.
No, it's not your fault.
Yeah, but it's not your
fault. Steve, thanks.
You didn't call the Cooper's Hawk hey.
No.
Take him out.
We make it easy for him, though.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well,
Steve, thanks for the update. Okay. And it happens. Right. You know, you like to think that birds have it easy, but birds have it really tough. They have a tough life, these poor little birds.
Yeah.
There's
always a hawk.
There's always a hawk around
the next corner. Yeah. It's a metaphor for life.
Very sad. All right, so we brought this book along, Birds Do It Too, The Amazing Sex Life of Birds by Kit and George Harrison.
Yeah, it's a fun little book. It's not super long. The chapters are short, but really funny and well-written.
So informative and entertaining at the same time.
Right, and it was published in 97. It's not super recent, but it's exhaustively researched. I mean, there's many pages of peer-reviewed literature that it's based on, but it's not that kind of a book. It's funny and lighthearted, but it's all legitimate essays on the different mating systems and some of the weird aspects of bird mating behavior. They just have great chapter titles. Let's see. I Want a Divorce. Pas de deux. Let's see. Free Love. Hippie Communes. And some of them are really dirty. I'm not even going to say them. Inflatable Dolls. What is that chapter?
I don't know
if I've gotten to that
one.
Chapter yet. Libidos in Overdrive. The Lady is a Tramp.
Oh, jeez.
So it's a fun little book that I've been kind of reading up on.
All right. So you mentioned the red-winged blackbirds, and we are seeing signs of springs. We are also seeing a sign of spring. The first woodcocks are displaying, right?
Yeah, I think a few overwinter, right? And so that's a bird that does not go far. Woodcocks are not flying to Patagonia. They're flying to, in some cases, Rhode Island or Maryland. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, listen for this now at night. Dusk. So, now what we're hearing now is the bird going up, straight up for hundreds of feet. And now this is the sound of them coming back down. They're wafting back and forth like a leaf dropping to the ground while they're making that chirping sound. It's a combination of vocal sounds and sounds made by specialized wing feathers, both up and down. Trying to impress the ladies. And so that's a real common theme in a lot of these bird mating systems, and also high school. I mean, it's like... we should talk about Lex at some point. But... this isn't quite a lek system. So the males will find a displaying ground, and it's an open area, adjacent to the kind of wet, thickety woods they like to be in. They like to eat earthworms. But they'll find an open place, and you can see this like behind the Stop and Shop parking lot in Orleans and in Harwich. I've had them there too. I mean, places that aren't exactly the most naturey places you can think of, you can find displaying woodcocks. And really, it's usually the end of February is when it starts. But, you get a warm period. The ground is not frozen right now. It's wet. There's probably earthworm activity. So they're feeling saucy, right? Like, ah, it's not even mid-February, but yeah, let's start displaying. Right? And so there have been a couple of different places. Maybe they were both in Barnstable, but it could be just about anywhere, really.
Yeah.
So if you want to check if you know of some places nearby where woodcocks display, it's time to start checking them, especially, you know, warmer nights like we're going to be having the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. It's a really interesting thing to see.
It's so cool. And all of the, you know, if you have a local nature center you go to, they almost always do woodcock walks this time of year, like usually March and April. And so you'll go out at night in a group and to a display ground, and it's really good. And you can do it yourself too, and it's really, and a classic thing to do would be to wait till the male launches himself up, right? And so he's like rocketing himself up high, and then you like scooch over to where he just was on the ground, so that you can be right next to him when he comes back down, and it works sometimes. You can like lay down, and he'll land right next to you, and then go back to the meh.
Meh.
Until the next time he launches up and whatever. These are the things we do to amuse ourselves. We're strange people, birders.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got an email that says, how early to put out hummingbird feeders along the south coast?
I mean, you know, I tell people to keep them up into December, but then at some point you have to give up the ghost. I eventually took mine down and realized I wasn't going to get a rare hummingbird this winter. But then the ruby-throated hummingbirds our normal breeding hummingbirds, start coming back. It used to be mid-May. It's really the beginning of May, but sometimes late April.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to have mine out definitely for the last week of April. And you'll be sitting watching an empty feeder. But you might get one of the early scouts or a bird passing through on its way to
Baltimore
New Hampshire
Orioles.
Or whatever.
Yeah, I get Baltimore Orioles at my hummingbird.
Yeah, so birds come back earlier. The longer distance they migrate, the less likely they are to come back earlier. But short distance migrants that can kind of, they're aware of what the weather is doing broadly in like the eastern U.S., they have been coming back earlier. But even, you know, hummingbirds go pretty far, but they seem to be coming back earlier, and the same with orioles, even though they're both coming from Central America. So it's good to be optimistic and get them out there late April and just be prepared to be watching an empty feeder for a little bit until, you know, by May they'll be back and they'll get established at your feeders again. Go ahead. Give the number.
866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You had more about hummingbirds.
Yeah. I was just going to segue, because we were talking about hummingbirds, which segues back into our continuing theme for Valentine's Day of bird love and bird mating. And hummingbirds are not very romantic. They have one of these polygynous systems where it's one male, many females. And the males, really all a male hummingbird does is establish a territory for displaying. And then within that territory, there'll be different females. And he just displays, mates with various females, and then they go off and nest. And he has nothing to do with the nests at all. And so maybe you've seen this. It's one of my favorite things, hummingbird male displays. It's just one of my favorite things in the bird world. And so our ruby-throated hummingbirds do this kind of J-shaped, bizarre flight where they go up high, then they come down and do a little U, and then they go back up high again. And the position of the J sort of changes, so they kind of rotate it around as they're doing it. And, you know, they're making little noises, and you're not aware of the female. You know there's a female somewhere when he's doing that.
He's showing off to somebody.
Right. And so then if you look closely, you'll see that, hidden in your rhododendron, there's the female just kind of sitting there, and she's watching him go up and watching him go down. She's, I don't know, maybe. evaluating him as a potential mate. And so, you know, when you see systems like this where the male is going through all these ridiculous things, it's a system that was probably evolved because of female choice. right? So really colorful males, crazy displays like the mannequins do in the tropics where they do these amazing dances and they clear a dance floor and the forest floor. And there's all these variations on this and the birds of paradise and the incredible displays they do. You know, it's in the colors, it's generally driven by female sexual selection has been the prevailing theory on how these things develop. And, you know, the bright gorget of the hummingbirds and their crazy flight dances they do. It's all about female choice. But then the females are on their own when it comes to actually nesting because the males are too busy.
Showing off for somebody else.
Too busy showing off for the females. All right, we have some questions.
Yeah, we do. We have John calling from Wellfleet. Hi, John.
Good morning. I just wanted to report a sighting, actually a couple of sightings of a snowy owl.
Oh.
Very nice.
And we were sitting, having lunch in our car at first encounter.
Oh, good.
And we were parked down, sort of down by the dunes and looking out over the marsh, not really seeing much of anything. All of a sudden, I looked off to my left, and there was a snowy owl flying right towards our car.
Wow.
Oh, very nice. You're very lucky. Yeah.
It flew right towards the driver's side window, which I was sitting in, and I'm yelling to my wife, look, look, look. And she turned, and there it was. Like you could see its face and everything, and its wingspan, and it flew right over the hood of our car. If I was outside, I could have touched it.
Wow.
That's how close it was.
I am very jealous.
So shocked.
Yeah. So
and
I.
Then,
oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you first.
Oh, okay. And then we're lucky enough in a 2-week span to see two snow owls. We saw one here. We live in Wellfleet. We saw one here in Wellfleet, but I promise I wouldn't tell where it was. But
ooh, secret owl.
I don't know if it could have been the same one, but.
It wasn't Great Island. Usually, if they're in Wellfleet, they're in Great Island. Occasionally, they'll fly across to the harbor. But first encounter, I go there a lot. And, you know, I've gone there specifically to look for them this year. There hasn't been a consistent one like there has been at West Dennis Beach. But they have been there on and off. And a few years ago when we had that crazy snowy owl winter where they were just everywhere, you know, you could see two or three at first encounter. And sometimes they would just be sitting on the dune right next to the parking lot as you drove along. But this year I've seen pictures of them there and I've seen the reports, but I don't think there's been one kind of consistently there. So you lucked out.
Yeah, you got there.
Well, the wingspan was amazing.
It's
hard to imagine.
They're huge birds. I mean, I got to see one up close recently. Our Mr. Snowy Owl at Mass Audubon, Norm Smith, up at the Trailside Museum there. He's the one who goes to Logan Airport and has been for 35 years or more, and studying them and putting satellite transmitters on them and everything. And I was at a meeting where he had been at Logan in the morning, and so he had one with him because he brings them to Duxbury Beach to release them. And so he had one. He brings it into this meeting, and he's walking around with this wild snowy owl that he had just captured at, you know, 4:30 that morning at Logan Airport. And, you know, you'd think I'd be jaded, but, you know, I was just blown away. And he brought it right next to me, and it's just the size of this thing and
huge,
the intensity of the stare. And you know what these birds do, that most of them are still up in the Arctic right now in total darkness, in unimaginable cold, picking ducks out of holes in the pack ice. You know, this animal leads a different life than we do.
Well, the eyes, we saw the eyes very well, and the eyes look totally black as it was coming towards us.
Oh, really? No, they're bright yellow.
Are they?
Usually. Oh, yeah, they're bright yellow eyes,
But John,
it was just the light reflected.
John, thanks for sharing.
We also saw bluebirds there, by the way.
Oh, bluebirds, too. Okay.
East Ham's a great place to see bluebirds. All around the edges of salt marshes, they like to be there. And really, any suburban neighborhood can have bluebirds. It's something we're lucky on the Cape. They winter here, and they like suburban neighborhoods. We have plenty of cedars and all kinds of other fruiting shrubs and trees for them.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing your story. From Tyler on Facebook. He says, Hi, guys, listening to the bird program and wanted to mention that our feeder out here on Nantucket, we've had a one-eyed cardinal make it through the winter so far. He's a daily occurrence, and since he points his one eye out at our window feeder, we get very close. Wonder what happened to his eye? Well, At least he's made it this far.
It's tough out there.
It is tough out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, birds make mistakes too and get a stick in the eye and, you know, it makes it harder. I mean, depth perception is important for us.
Really important for
think
birds.
Think of a bird that, you know, needs to be very precisely picking insects off of leaves and things like that. So he's a tough one if he's still
hopefully
plugging.
He makes it. All right, Bill is calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Mindy.
Hello.
Hello there. I'm sort of an accidental birder, I suppose. I'm a commercial fisherman. I'm in Wellfleet right now working on my boat, but I live in Orleans. I fish out of Provincetown or Chatham. And I've gone to sea a long time, and my relationship with the birding populations, mainly through my experiences at sea. But I had a statement to make that I just feel like I had to share with you both, and that's that when we lost Vern, I thought I would never be able to listen to another bird or speak because he was so dynamic, so intelligent, so magnificent. But I want to tell you that I'm very impressed with the work that you do and your ability to express your ideas about birds and nature.
Wow. Bill, I really appreciate that. I can't tell you how much that means to me. Talking about big shoes to fill, and it's really heartening to hear things like that, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, and Bill, thank you. Thanks for sharing that, and I know Vern would be happy to hear that as well. I mean, that was the one thing about Vern. He wanted to spread the word of birds to anybody who would listen, and his passion was certainly contagious, and hopefully he's watching down and you know. Yeah.
Such a good ambassador for birds.
Absolutely. Yeah. Bill, thanks. Thanks for sharing that. Appreciate
you are.
That.
You too.
All right. So we got an email from Joe who says, when and where should I put dryer lint for nesting material?
You can put it anywhere. Just put it outside.
And is now a good time? Not quite yet, right?
Yeah, no songbirds are really nesting right now. And, you know, this actually goes back to that first research project I was talking about with the gray jays up north. And the way they would find nests is they would give them bits of cotton. They would call them in because they love people. And they would give them little bits of cotton and then try to watch where they go to find their nests because they were trying to study them. And so, yeah, birds love soft things like that. So you can put out dryer lint and pet fur and human hair and all that kind of stuff, and they'll use it. And if you don't put it out, you might get situations where I've seen photos of tufted titmice that, like, land on your dog, and the dog's laying on the deck. The titmouse comes in and just plucks fur off the dog, you know. So, yeah, you know, March and April, you can start doing that for some of the earliest nesters. May nesting's in full swing, a lot of the local birds. But some of the local birds start early, house finches and things that don't migrate. One of the benefits of not migrating is that you can start nesting earlier than the warblers and things that leave. And so, so some of our resident birds will be nesting in like April.
Yeah. All right. So we have to talk about this. You, woodpecker brains and concussion research. This is kind of interesting. There was a study that found that woodpecker brains have some of the same protein found in football players.
Yeah. Right. And so, it was some folks at Boston University, you know, thinking about all this research going on around concussions and the controversy about, you know, NFL players and chronic traumatic encephalopathy that they get from repeated head blows over the course of their careers and that kind of thing. And so there's been a lot of research in the past about woodpeckers and this whole idea of, you know, why don't woodpeckers get headaches? Like, you know, like Mike O'Connor's book. And it's a good question. And there have been different answers to it. People always talk about their specialized skulls, but I'm not sure that has much to do with it. There was a professor at MIT whose name escapes me right now who pointed out that it's really about the scaling. And so because their brains and their skulls are smaller, that just by the laws of scaling, they can withstand much higher G-force concussing of their brain than people can, just by the nature of the fact that they're smaller and the brain is hitting a smaller surface area. Anyway, so that seems to be how they avoid, you know, concussing themselves to death with these repeated, like, 1,500 G-force blows to feed and to drum for their territorial drumming. It just over and over again, it's mind-blowing that they survived this. You know, nobody ever looked to see if there was evidence of brain damage. And they didn't find a smoking gun, but they did find a common protein, this tau protein. Mm-hmm. It's been found in animals before, but it is also, it's a protein that's associated with the pathology of CTE and repeated concussions in people. And so it was an interesting, kind of an interesting finding. They don't know what role that protein plays. Apparently, it can even have some sort of a protective role, or they haven't ruled out that they've evolved a way for that protein to have a protective role in their brains. But if it bunches up in a certain way, it's has pathological effects in people.
Okay, but this is really interesting because this could, you know, the fact that the woodpeckers have this protein, this tau, and they're not showing some of the signs of you know, brain injury, that what does that mean? I mean, it raises a lot of questions, but yes, it also raises a lot of hope that there could be some information there that could be helpful to humans.
Exactly. So this could be a fruitful area of research. Look to the woodpeckers.
That's right.
Do we have time to talk about the scholarship?
Yes, that's going to be my next question, so talk about the scholarship.
All right, so, you know, I'm on the board of Cape Cod Bird Club, and for years we've had this really great scholarship program where we send a Cape Cod teen, sometimes two, to the Hog Island National Audubon Birding Camp in Maine sometime in June. And it's been great, and the kids that have gone have loved it, and we have them present about their experiences there at our December meeting. And we advertise it in all the local schools, and I used to do that as part of my role on the board. But this year, we didn't get any applicants. We haven't gotten any applicants yet. And
what's the deadline?
I think we have a few more weeks before we have to withdraw our spaces that we've reserved in the camp, and I think enrollment is down this year. But typically, we'll get a few applicants at least. So if you know of a young birder, a teenage birder, you know, kind of middle school to high school age, that would like to go to this camp, just go to the Cape Cod Bird Club website, check out our scholarship program. It'll be right there, one of the main headings, and have them apply. Even if they're just, you know, just maybe interested in birding a little bit and don't want to admit it, they'll be with other birders. It'll be okay. No one will make fun of them at this camp. They'll be with like-minded kids.
Hey, listen, birding's become cool, so it's not like that anymore.
Finally. Oh,
real quick, I want to get Joan in from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning.
Hi, Joan.
Mark, you wanted to know about feeder wars.
Oh, yeah.
Red-bellied just beat out a flicker on the suet bowl.
Oh.
That's it. That's my report for the day.
Interesting.
Thank you, Joan.
Interesting. That kind of goes against the conventional wisdom of the research where size... size equates to dominance, and so red-bellied is a good bit smaller than a flicker. Flickers are huge for a woodpecker, and so interesting. Thanks, Joan.
Well, and you just like the osprey beating up the owl. I mean, the eagle.
Yeah, right.
You know?
You just
don't know. All right, we have about a minute left, so things people should be thinking about in their yards as far as preparing for spring breeding season. Do we want to take the birdhouses down now and clean them out, or is it too early for that?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, maybe put up an owl box now. You know, it's best to put them up in the fall. Clean out your bird boxes. The bluebirds that are kind of resident, they'll be starting to check out boxes, you know, in March, throughout March. So it's good to have it cleaned out and spruced up. Male, when he's showing the female that box, he can impress her and she'll say, yes, I will nest there.
Why, honey, I love this nice, clean home.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Mark Faraday is the science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Joins us the second Tuesday of every month. Thanks, Mark.
See you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.